Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
All right. Today we are stepping into one of the most extraordinary and troubling cases I think that we've ever covered, and we still don't know most of the details. That's what makes it so damn elusive. It's the case that isn't just about one act of violence, but about what can fester inside a justice system when power goes unchecked. In September 2024, inside the Lector County Courthouse in Whitesburg, Kentucky, Sheriff Sean Mickey Steins walked into the chambers of District Judge Kevin Mullins. It opened fire. We all saw it on video. Judge Mullins died there in his own office. The entire shooting captured on courthouse surveillance. Steins surrendered immediately. He's now indicted for the murder of a public official and awaiting trial. But that single moment didn't happen in a vacuum. 3 days earlier, Steins had been deposed in a federal civil rights lawsuit, Adkins versus Fields. That alleges a pattern of sexual exploitation and coercion tied to the very courthouse where the shooting occurred. In that suit, a former home incarceration officer has already pled guilty for SA, sodomy, and tampering. Plaintiffs allege some of the misconduct took place inside Judge Mullins' chambers. Steins was named in that lawsuit for alleged failures of supervision, though not accused of any sort of SA wrongdoing himself. After the shooting, body cam footage shows Steins distraught and paranoid, pleading not to be harmed. His lawyers have filed notice of an insanity or extreme emotional disturbance defense. Prosecutors are opposing bond and have not ruled out seeking the death penalty. At the time, women are now stepping forward publicly, some on the record, with journalists like Brian Anton describing how power, fear, and retaliation kept them silent for years. They've alleged ask-for-favors arrangements, threats of losing their children, and a courthouse culture that blurred the line between justice and exploitation. These are allegations, not criminal convictions against Judge Mullins, but they frame the environment Steins inhabited before he pulled the trigger. This isn't just a Kentucky story. It's a cautionary tale about what can happen when a small town justice system becomes a closed ecosystem and accountability collapses. How does an officer sworn to uphold the law reach the point of killing a judge? How do victims weigh speaking out when every official holds power over their freedom? And how can a community rebuild trust when the courthouse itself has become the crime scene? To help us untangle the behavior in this and the power dynamics at play, Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Robin, I just saw the interview recently Brian Anton did with another one of the individuals who's making claims of the ask for favors situation there in the courthouse. And then you got the sheriff, who just days earlier was in that deposition, certainly had a good understanding of what the charges were at stake and what was going on. What kind of psychological profile do you think the sheriff had as he walked into that courthouse that day that he took the judge's life?
Boy, I've gone full circle on this one a couple times, Tony, because we keep getting more data coming in. And I'm boiling it down to this right now. With more data coming in, we're starting to see a lot more smoke. Mm-hmm. When I first started seeing this, I was like, I was thinking we got a very rare occurrence of a potential psychotic break. Because some data points are going in that direction because of patterns of his past behavior and all those things. But as we start, and as Brian Etten's doing a great job of seeing smoke, we might not have quite the psychotic break I was originally thinking. Because if so, psychotic breaks, typically if someone is having an episode, they're very random. The paranoia goes in there, which we're seeing some things with him wearing his vest and all those things that have been reported. But what's pulling me away from the psychotic break, and we might have a pattern of really bad, abhorrent behavior that led to this, is the fact that all of his actions of apparently being paranoid were centered around the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking we're going to find out a lot of dirty things in the days and weeks to come. And I think he had a plan. I think he'd been planning it for a while. Because that's where I'm leaning to right now. I'm less on the side of the psychotic break thing. I think he knew exactly what he was doing and why he was doing it.
Almost the courthouse being a triggering factor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing, considering when you consider the chambers itself are at play in this conversation of the allegations that things were happening in the judge's chamber itself. How much do you think, I mean, we are missing a big piece here because, well, Kevin Mullins is dead, the judge, and the allegations are that some of these things took place in his chambers. He is not listed in that civil suit, but obviously another individual is, and there has been charges there. But the fact that his own office, his own chambers, basically being listed as a place where some of these things took place, and there has been allegations. Again, Kevin's dead. How much are we missing here because he's dead? Before I ask too many other questions.
Yeah, I think he's going to be obviously a centerpiece of the puzzle because that's where the seat of power was and the power of control. You know, I started getting tinges of Alec Murdoch case on this.
Yeah.
Just because of that power control and small town vibe, you know, kind of almost a little like Richard Allen and Delphi, small town.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see, again, as investigators, hopefully what they're doing is, and I don't have any reason not to believe it, is when you see smoke and you have allegations, you have to run all those allegations down. And even though you have a seat of power at the top, which is controlling things, there's going to be people around them, especially since there was charges against someone else, one of the bailiffs, I think it was, you know, in this case. And so I'm hoping we're going to get some data leakage on this one. Because his behavior, the sheriff's behavior, changed at a very certain point, and it became very focused. Even though that observed paranoia became very focused again around that courthouse, around a lot of a lot of crazy unhealthy behavior, isn't there? That seemed to pop up and spring up. I think, again, if I'm throwing on my conjecture hat, which is all we have at this point, is that he all of a sudden had an aha moment. And when his aha moment happened, he then put on his investigator hat and took a deeper dive, and he didn't like what he found. And I think, again, pure conjecture at this point. But that leads me more to the plan rather than a psychotic break.
Yeah.
Robin.
Yes, Stacey.
So I've got a question, and obviously it's a very broad question. Do you think this is going on in other municipalities across the nation? Do you think this is a one-off? Do you think that there are elements of this? Just based on what you've seen in your career, do you think that this is something that's going on in other communities, that there's just this bubbling cauldron of something that's about to blow in another community?
So I don't think it's systemic, as a quick answer, because it's just not. But at the same time, the old rule of if you see one, there's probably 10 others. And so, and typically what we do and what we do here and what media does is it's easier to kind of find and focus on the abhorrent behavior. And one of the reasons we do that is so we can prevent it in other areas too, because in each case that we look at and examine, there's red flags that led up to this. And one of the things we do as both opinion pieces that we do, as well as investigative pieces that we try to, I think, blend the two together here, is bring light to it so we can prevent these things from happening in all the other cases. But that being said, I don't think systemic, because why are these things not systemic? Because a lot of people have to know, and by and large, as a species, we are good people. We want to do moral and ethical things. One of the reasons we have laws is to have accountability for each other. And, you know, we are our brother's keeper. And so in these larger municipalities, it's harder to do these things. But are there smaller areas where there's family control for a period of time? There's a slow boiling frog, which a little bit of bad behavior here over a period of time escalating becomes more acceptable and more and more acceptable until you have one person that finally says, I've had enough, or they move in from out of town and they're not part of that cult. And so, but again, long answer to, I don't think systemic, but I think there's others? Yes. It's hard not to imagine there isn't others.
It makes you wonder just, you know, how much of it, they all kind of, when it happens, it comes to the surface at different times. It doesn't seem like this is coming to the surface because of any sort of other existential factors in society. I mean, it's more so other than, you know, this event exposed it, there already was an event that exposed it, the initial lawsuit that was filed, and then others realizing, oh gosh, we haven't heard a lot of anything from anybody within the law enforcement area, within the courthouse area, within anything of the legal judicial system, people who work in that building, basically. We've heard a lot from other people on the outside. A lot of women have come forward with these allegations of coercion tied to their legal outcomes. Why do you think it is that we haven't heard a lot of, I don't know, tampering that down if it's not true? You would think that if some of these things were not really going on, you would hear a lot more, that's not how our courthouse works. No, we hear like dead silence. It seems to be a lot of crickets about what actually goes on in this courthouse from anyone who's working the front desk to, you know, the judge.
Yeah, what people don't say is almost as important as what people do say. You can learn a lot by what is said and what is not said, timing of all those things. And yeah, silence can be deafening and can be very revealing as well. And again, you can't jump to a conclusion, but you can also say we need to take a deeper look, because why isn't that happening? What's the goal and objective of not saying something? Is it because they're really well organized in their media releases and their public publicity people, or is because they're deathly afraid? You know, fear is always the greatest motivator of all of us, and it's what keeps people from saying things is fear, and then we rationalize our behaviors. So it, could all this be going on? It's possible.
And I want to talk about that, the rationalizing of the behaviors. And I'm not saying like everybody in this courthouse is doing something wrong, but there's a lot of people, I'm going to assume, in the courthouse who have some knowledge of the wrongdoing, or at least the inkling of it. And it's like, well, what am I going to do about it? I work over here at the mail room, as if that's even a position anymore. Mm-hmm. But other ancillary parts around the building where they weren't involved in these things, but, you know, rumors travel and you go, oh, I think I know that that's going on. But there's nothing they could have done about it if they wanted to stay employed. Right. And there's that pressure to be quiet, because if you were to make an accusation and you can't prove it, well, then you're going to get sued. And so there's a lot of reasons to be quiet. But at the same point, is it, I guess I'm wondering how much, when you're living in an environment like that day after day, is it living in fear of exposing it, or is it just, it's so normalized? I'm wondering how people in that courthouse are feeling right now as all this goes on. On the outside, we look at this going, oh my gosh, like this is twisted stuff here. Right? And if we were to assume that others have some knowledge here and are, you know, doing exactly what I just said, are they living in fear? Or I'm wondering if they're looking at this as, oh, come on, this happens everywhere. The rationalizing of the behavior. It's not good, but I wonder how much of that goes on that also further solidifies the thought that there's this level of unhealthy craziness around it, but we can't quite accept the level to which it is because it's so extreme, so we normalize it down to another place.
It's probably a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
So here's one of the laws of human nature is we're always going to act in our own best interest in terms of our safety, security, and prosperity from our own point of view, from whatever context and situation we're living in. And so all these individuals are acting in what they think is their best interest and comes down to fear of reprisal, fear of not being able to move. And what that looks like to that individual could be very different. So say you have one individual that is witting that, hey, something was going on. So they're going to keep their mouth shut because they're fearful that someone's going to find out that they were involved. You can have others that had no idea anything's going on, but now they're hearing these allegations and they're fearful of being connected in some way. So they're going to keep their heads down. There's mm-hmm. all kinds of reasons why people are taking the actions they're taking. And it's hard to predict exactly what's causing it, but we're getting data on all this. And so the rationalizing of it, we rationalize things when we want to believe, what we want to believe. Mm-hmm. And if we have a job, because remember, we're going to act in our own best interest, as I said, for ourselves and our families, those we care about. And if we don't feel we have other options, if we feel like we're trapped and we only get an inkling of this might be going on, isn't it going on? If I had an option, if I don't have direct firsthand knowledge, again, there's not going to be a lot of people that have very, very clear firsthand knowledge if anything was going on with the judge or anyone else. It's going to be a very, very small, tight circle. Now, there's going to be leakage of other people that might think or might not think something was going on. What happens is, if you don't want to believe it, what do we do with our confirmation bias? We're going to look at and only take in data that's going to help us rationalize nothing was going on. Mm-hmm. So we can feel better about who we are, because we don't want to be the type of person that allows abhorrent behavior to go on around us or even be associated with that as in a workplace, because that will destroy our own self-image. It'll destroy our own being. And so that's how we as human beings will rationalize otherwise really, really abhorrent behavior. And then you cascade on top of it groupthink. Mm-hmm. Well, if no one else is saying anything, it must be all right. And I like Billy Bob Joe. He's a great guy. And
Billy Bob Joe's great.
I love Billy Bob Joe.
You know, he's a half step above Schmuckatelli.
Yes, he is. I like Billy Bob.
You know, but these people, you know, they will look to others to gauge what their behavior and reaction should be. And if you have someone you respect in your life, you have someone that has time, a lot more time in a position than you do, and you see what they're doing and what their behaviors are, and then you try to understand them and say, well, this is a really good family person. They have a really good standing. They're really good in their church. They're good morals and ethics. And if they're not saying anything here, it must be okay. And so I'll just look the other way, because maybe there's no other way to look. That's how we as human beings do this, because if we did anything other than this, we'd be invalidating ourselves. We don't like doing that. It hurts us psychologically.
Mm-hmm. You know, Tony, you and I have worked in places, and I'm nothing like this went on, but you and I have worked in similar places where there were things going on and people kind of looked the other way, and it was a family organization.
Yeah.
You kind of get into this mode where it's self-preservation. I need this job. I need to continue with what I'm doing. This is my career. But yet, at some point, you do break. I mean, Robin, you're 100% correct. At one point, the volcano just blows, and you got to go. You got to get out. You got to figure out something different because you can't tolerate it. But it's amazing how humans can just do the status quo because it's just easier. It's just easier.
And so, Stacey, to your point, this is exactly what you need to do, not you, but people need to do if you're going to be an investigator, but going to be an interviewer, is what we just did here is we just did a very deep dive on empathy. Because now that you understand those people, again, if there's anything going on, but it doesn't matter. Regardless, they're going to be interviewing all these people in that courthouse. They're going to be interviewing people that are surrounding these allegations. And if you're going to go in and interview someone, you can't go in and interview thinking in your head, oh, if you let this go on, you're really, really a horrible individual and a horrible human being. And I'm going to sit here and judge the living hell out of you for this. Do you think the likelihood of you making a connection and them sharing with you all that was going on is high or low? It's extremely low. So you have to go in with an understanding of what would compel someone to not say something. Mm-hmm. Well, we just went through it. And then you can empathize with it. It doesn't mean you agree that it was the right or wrong thing to do. Yeah. Just understand the decision process. We walked a mile in their shoes and said, hey, this is a really tough situation you're in. You know, what can we do together maybe to move the ball forward a little bit to right some wrongs that others did, you know, together? So that's how we do these interviews. This is how we get to the truth, is always thinking in terms of what can I do to inspire someone to share the truth with me before they have an opportunity to deceive. And that's how you do it. You dive deep to understand them, and so that you don't do the worst thing in the world is take a look at some shame and say, hey, look at your shame. Now tell me everything. It never works.
It doesn't work. They put up their walls even harder.
Oh, sure.
Know, they reinforce those walls to keep you from getting the information you're looking for.
I want to talk about the confirmation bias that could exist if the trial does take place there in Lecter County. I know they're talking about possibly moving it. And I think you can look at it from both ways in some perspectives, but I want to look at it this way because I don't think a lot of people are seeing it. One could look at it and go, oh, well, if this is happening in their town, then they're going to find him guilty no matter what, just because. I don't know. What I'm wondering about in the confirmation bias here is in this kind of small knit community, you don't necessarily want to believe these sort of things are going on. And a lot of the victims that you have here have criminal records, substance abuse issues, CPS involvement. They're not clean slates. And in no way does that mean that these people are lying or making things up. No, these are oftentimes the victims of these sort of things. But again, that's asking human beings to understand, you know, psychology and think more than one thought ahead. That being said, you're going to have a lot of witnesses here that are, as you know, again, I'm not trying to denigrate these people at all, but if you're on the jury and you're seeing them come in, some are going to go, oh, they're kind of icky. They're kind of, you know, I wouldn't do that. I don't have a record. I didn't have this problem. I didn't have that problem. And people will go for that sort of a bias. And I could see in some cases then discrediting them mentally, whether they deserve it or not, or just automatically doing that. Because again, they don't want to believe this is going on in their own town. And preserving that image in their mind, whether, you know, even though it is going on in their own town, mm-hmm. and there is evidence for it. I wonder how much that kind of an angle, and that could be an issue here if they do keep this trial in Lecter County.
It's definitely something that the lawyers deal with. And again, I'm not a lawyer, defense or prosecutor, but one way you counter that, at least as a behavior guy, this is the way I counter that, is so let's think about it. How would you overcome a negative confirmation bias with someone who's saying that this person did abhorrent things? We knew the judge was doing this, you know, sexual favors for lighter sentences or whatever it was. And this person's got a really shady, creepy background. Mm-hmm. If you're painting it in that picture of right now of shady, creepy background and you're trying to discredit, what I do is what we do here all the time is, well, let's take a deeper look at this life arc. You know, we'll go with Sally Jane on this one. Sally Jane, tell me about what it was like growing up for you. So, mm-hmm. So in other words, what they do is you humanize the individual. And then when you start humanizing that individual, the words they say mean a lot more than just some subjective, you know, thing that is just a title and label of, oh, they're a drug addict, they're an alcoholic. Well, that's dehumanizing someone. If you humanize them, the words coming out of their mouth tend to mean a lot more because, again, the defense attorney or whatever is going to walk them in their shoes so you can understand them. And then the other key thing is to demonstrate that this is not someone with an axe to grind. This is someone who's actually making amends in their lives. They're just merely laying out facts and details. And here's how you do it. You have to trust them.
Yeah.
And the way you trust people is, again, they have to show transparency, openness, and vulnerability. Those behaviors inspire someone to believe you. So when you can actually own your behavior, yes, I was this person. Here's the things I did wrong in my life. Here's what I've gone in my life. And they don't try to sell you on anything. They allow you to make the choice on how you think they are now. Because mm-hmm. I've seen some of these people have actually reformed their lives pretty well. A lot of people, when they go through some trauma, they reform their lives well. So, and if you have a lot of allegations or enough allegations that you're going to have a couple of these individuals that have actually been on this journey of, all right, I started out a beautiful human being like we all do. I went through some real good trauma that really destroyed me, and I hit my bottom. When I hit the bottom, I was in the jail system, in the court system, and all these things, and then all these horrendous things happened to me. But I crawled myself up out of here, and here's just the facts, ma'am. Boom. And mm-hmm. then the jury makes a decision. So instead of just saying a drug addict, we now have an arc of a human being that they have a lot more credibility now, because who hasn't hit their own bottom?
Yeah.
Who hasn't done these things? So that's what I would do.
I mean, that's going to be the job of the attorneys to really, yeah, to sell it to the jury, no matter. Do you think something like this, though, needs to be moved out of that county no matter what, just because it's just too close to home? It's too tight-knit. It's too small. I mean, you're talking about literally having the trial in the place where there's allegations of all this corruption going on.
I mean, my humble opinion, it would probably help it. Because of those things, because fear, yeah, you know, you want people to not be fearful and waiting for confirmation, yeah, bias one way or the other, which is why we have a jury. You know, juries, mm-hmm, hopefully are mitigating all these things when they're doing jury selection, because you cannot avoid. And if you're like us all, we, mm-hmm, all have confirmation bias. It's okay. Yeah. But yeah, why we have loving critics in our lives, why we have juries of peers. It's why we have prosecution defenses. It's to help us overcome our human frailties of the confirmation bias. But I think moving the venue would probably help. But again, I'm not the expert in that area.
Yeah, I would. I don't know how you couldn't move the. You don't even have to, I would feel like, in a case like this. If there's ever a case that calls for it, where the corruption is literally in the building that you're going to try and get the case amongst pieces of the infrastructure that would have been in place for allowing some of this stuff to happen. And let's say they've cleaned house. Let's say it's all fresh and so clean. But it's still, you know, it the optics, all of that, it needs, you know, so they have to think about that.
I mean, just think about this. Not making the attempt would also be pretty telling too, would it?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but these people run into all of these people at church and the grocery store. And even if they did clean house, everybody knows somebody in this community. So even though it's a jury of their peers, I think there's still that pressure from the community that you want to protect the infrastructure that's been there for probably a century. Everybody knows everybody, you know?
And the level of personalization, like we said, you know, if you have a personal relationship with someone and you know, and you're going to rationalize how you, because it all it's going to take is probable doubt, mm-hmm, you know, in one person. I think it's a very tricky situation, but I definitely think it helps move it away from there as much as possible to get a jury pool with less knowledge of this. And again, everyone's going to know about it in that whole area, but just less, I guess a better way to put it, less personal connection to this.
What do you make of this? Several interviewees describe being warned not to report the misconduct. This is an allegation that has been made. There's, you know, don't, because it, you know, will ruin your, it wasn't just will ruin your reputation or no one will believe you. The allegation is that some were told they'd be found dead over a mountain. That's kind of that's a harsh one. That's a harsh thing to say to somebody after, well, anything, for any reason, but especially after you violated them in a horrible way. You, mm-hmm, talk about this, we're going to, you'll be found dead somewhere.
Sounds like the mafia, doesn't it?
For a little bit. I mean, and I'm wondering, okay, just threats? Or have they ever carried that out? I retrospectively looking on this, that kind of makes me want to look at suspicious deaths in the area over the last handful of years, like over the however long these people have been there, or even longer. Because look, I'm usually things like this just don't happen in a vacuum. It's not always just one person that decides to completely change the way that this ecosystem works. Usually in these judicial type systems, when there's systematic corruption or generational corruption, it's just that, it's generational. It keeps going. Well, the former ones did it this way too. Look at the new perks of the job you have, Mr. Judge. Wait, that's a perk? I mean, yeah. I mean, in some horrible, horrible way, if you have a very sick mind, some of these things, people are like, oh, wow, I can get away with this. It makes me wonder, would you have, are you suspicious at all about, if in fact that threat was made, about, I wonder if they ever did carry that out at some point in time, if there's some legitimacy to that threat?
Yeah, it's definitely something I think they need to investigate that as well, because in order for a threat to be effective, it has to have teeth. And how do threats have teeth? Well, they have to have a past example of it being just that. When I saw that death threat as well, and even because this goes to the sheriff starting to wear the vest around and him making the claims that he feared for himself and his wife, his daughter, that seemed very odd to me. I think that's why people were looking at that whole psychotic break and paranoia, maybe. Mm-hmm. unless he found out something about those threats being actually very tangible, very real, because that's what gives things teeth and legs. And again, but that happens if it is systemic over time, and it's a known established fact that if that threat is made, it has the ability to be carried out upon. And I have this example, whether the example is factual in your own mind or it's just urban legend, it still has the same power over you. So urban legend could play a part in it, but it definitely needs to be flushed out. All these things. I mean, just think about every time I see cases like this, I just think about every time we're saying here, this needs to be looked at. This person needs to be interviewed. I'm just thinking about the bandwidth of individuals that need to be interviewed, processed, assimilated, and who's doing that and what's their objectivity.
Mm-hmm. They'd have to call in outside people to do all of this. Just, 100%. You know, I mean, haul somebody in, put up a trailer outside, and they literally live there for like a year or two to interview people. There's no way that somebody inside this community can be doing the interviews. There's just no way.
Yeah. This is just such a mess in that community. I want to go there and just hang out for a week and have coffee at the local diner and talk.
You get a vibe. You know, I think it's, and that's why I love, and you cited Brian Enton at the very beginning. You know, he does a really good job of getting the vibe on the ground. You know, because walking the ground, you know, as I used to say, touch it, taste it, feel it. Because when you get the energy there and you actually do the interaction, it gives a lot of context to the data we see from, you know, from 30,000 miles, that's a long way, you know, from 3,000 miles away to that. But that's why it's really, really important to walk the ground, interaction, to feel, you know, just the tenor and tempo of the people around you. It goes a long way.
Yeah, there's some very interesting interviews that he's done with some of the folks there. His channel is Brian Enton Investigates, if you want to check them out in their entirety. Let us know your thoughts in the comments section on this case. We would love to hear that.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice, and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.